Well, John Rapoport, I just, before we begin, first of all, of course, always thank you so much for being on the Saleri Report and being part of the world that our Saleri subscribers dip into and enjoy. I have to compliment you on your recent, you've had a whole period of work where, you know, if we want to cut to the chase and get down to the nitty gritty, you just look at your blog post every day and talk about cut to the chase with John Rapoport. You've really been in a period of remarkable productivity.
Thank you. Yeah, it's the last 6 months or so, something new has happened for sure. If you keep going long enough, you just move up onto new levels, as you well know.
Right. Okay, well, we want to talk about human communications, and particularly communications across the divide of reality and official reality. We are getting more and more requests for help with this topic, sometimes in specific areas like vaccines is one of them, but also sort of how do you communicate, work with, deal with people who have a very divergent picture of reality, not just because they're from a different country or a different place, but because they are completely, you know, committed or imbued with the official reality. And I've been working to try and create sort of an organizational chart to show all the different fact patterns. And what I quickly realized is given the many different kinds of relationships and the many different kinds of risks and the complexity of our society, it gets real complex real quick. So yeah. I will just say that this is an exploration and we're beginning to explore the topic because there's a, you know, this is something we're all trying to figure out in an event. And particularly given the different technologies that we're dealing with, I would say that the invasiveness of the official reality versus reality is something very new.
It sure seems to be. The technology especially has so many effects that there are layers and layers of it.
Well, so let's just dive in. I wanted to start by talking about what creates the official reality and what's behind it, some of the carrot and stick. So maybe if you could just, what is the official reality? Or what is the difference? You know, what's reality versus official reality?
Well, official reality to me is all about concealing an agenda under the guise of reporting of fact, consensus, even evidence that's cooked that isn't real. So you have a whole phalanx of people employed openly, covertly, on all levels, whose job it is to make it seem as if a pretended reality is the real thing. And their agenda, of course, is to convince people of certain things, make them do things, keep them from doing things, and so the strategy is, well, let's see, if we present this issue this way and we make it seem as if we're just reporting what is true when we know it isn't, we stand a good chance of convincing the bulk of the population rather than argue for a particular point of view or say, this is our stance on this, and so forth. All of that is completely gone by the boards. What we're dealing with now is an attempt to create fictions that appear to be fact. How do you do that? Well, there's all kinds of strategies for doing that, and with the technology, of course, it becomes much easier in a way to do that. So to me, that's the key difference. You've got people that whose job it is to show you something and make you think that it's actually fact when it's all agenda.
One of my favorite aspects of your work is how much you've written and taught about the power we have to invent our own reality. And when you begin to explore it, what you realize is, you know, the human race's ability to invent, you know, whether it's a product, a place, a building, but a future, to the ability that we have to invent and imagine is quite extraordinary. And if there's anything, it seems to me, that terrifies the people who govern the planet, it's that power. And, you know, the official reality is very much trying to get the world to imagine that the official reality is the reality and support it, as opposed to simply use their imagination to invent their own reality.
Yeah, that to me is the crucial difference. And you've
right.
put it very well. No question about it. That's the key line in the sand, so to speak. You know, what will make an individual give away his own imagination and say, essentially, I want to imagine what the official reality is, and I want to imagine that's really true because it suits me to do that, or I'm too lazy to do anything else, or I think I can, if I do that, I'll have an advantage with my peers, colleagues, friends, a variety of reasons. And all of this is really going on, in a way, on a subconscious level.
Right.
People are not generally going to say out loud, yeah, the one thing I really want to do is to imagine what the consensus is imagining for me, or what the manipulators are imagining. That's not really going to happen. You just kind of fall into it. But the power for the individual drains away. It's just, you know, the old phrase, giving away your power. Well, this is giving away your imagination.
One of the things I think that really locks us all into the official reality is it really is not easy to figure out what reality is. You know, if you look at the governance system, we live on a planet where the governance system is secret and invisible, and where there's an extraordinary amount of money being made to keep us in the consensus reality, because the consensus reality is designed to produce an enormous, you know, financial harvest to the centralized system. So, and this is why I love your DVD on Merlin and the Age of Magic, because it describes how we're being reorganized into basically a machinery, an economic machinery that can produce a dividend. And you know, if you look at the technologies and the different tactics they have to keep us incentivized to stay in that harvesting machine, it's pretty significant.
Yeah, for a lot of people, it's completely overwhelming because they can't see any other alternative. What else would I do except this? But of
right.
course, there's many things that an individual could do if he could just take a little bit of time and step back and begin to understand, you know, what's happening. To me, I like sometimes to put it on the basis of art. All great organizations with tremendous power down through history have recognized the power of art to literally paint a picture that other people will accept. And they do it in the biggest possible terms, the most authoritative way, with the most possible financial support, so that other people will look at this picture and say, well, how could there be anything else? This is it. This is reality. I mean, this so to speak, this fresco is 20 feet high and 70 feet long. I mean, you know, what else could it be? I mean, this whole thing is some kind of a prop job. It's some sort of a deception here. That couldn't be. Look at all the great stained glass windows and the structures and
uh-huh.
this and that. I mean, this has to be it. This is what I've been looking for, so I'm just going to sign up.
Right. Well, how could I possibly invent anything more fun than a Disney movie, right?
Right.
Okay, well, let's talk about some of the carrot. I call them carrot and sticks. I think one of the most important things is getting people to believe in what I call the deprivation model. I once took a wonderful group of people that I am in cahoots with, and I said, you know, what do you think the total wealth on planet Earth could be? And we estimated that current wealth was about 1 to 20% of what would be possible if we were just free to, you know, to practice freedom in markets. And I think that's surprising for most people because they, you know, they don't believe in an abundant world. And they don't appreciate how much money is wasted in just making sure, you know, the whole thing is centralized and controlled.
Yeah, I'd like to hear more about the deprivation model. I like that phrase.
You have to work hard. I love the book. One of my favorite financial books is Rich Dad, Poor Dad. And Robert Kiyosaki basically describes, you know, having a father and a stepfather, one who's very entrepreneurial and wants you to kind of invent your own incomes and your own economic life, and the other is you got to get a job and you got to work hard. It's tough. And it's basically a description of the abundance model versus the deprivation model. Another thing, frankly, is the legal model, because if we live in a world where the laws and regulations get more and more complicated every day, and it's basically an entrapment model. It is. We've reached a point where it's impossible to be compliant because it's impossible to know every law you're supposed to be compliant with. There's a great documentary somebody wrote called Beyond Terms and Conditions, and they estimated if we all truly read the terms and conditions we all agree to when we use software, we would spend 3 to 4 months a year just reading terms and conditions.
I was just going to say that, because recently I've had to look over some legal documents where signatures and initials were necessary. I'm talking about maybe 20 signatures and initials in a single long document. And this was presented to me as, you know, this is just boilerplate. And we need to get rolling here. So do this as quickly as you can. Everybody does it. And I said, oh, well, I'm not going to do that. And so I started to read, actually, the text. And after maybe a minute, I was just totally lost, absolutely lost. I had no idea what I was reading, and I could see that I was just beginning to dip into the whole thing, and that if I actually took my time, it would be, I don't know, I could spend a week easily doing nothing but just reading that document, trying to figure out what it said before I initialed anything. And that was just one document. So I agree completely. It's total entrapment. Total entrapment.
Right. I've run into so many situations. I had a great situation where a Bible class teacher came to me. She couldn't understand her options for a 401k, and she was very disturbed because she felt like she had to take personal responsibility. And she said the woman who you called for questions on the plan was so mean, she didn't know what to do. Anyway, she was interested in a fund that was mortgage-backed securities. So I agreed I would get on the phone and help her. And so we called the woman. She sent me the documents, and I said, you know, I don't understand them. So I said, let's call the woman. So we called the woman at the plan. She was so mean, John. I mean, it was really scary how mean she was. And I just said to him, look, Bertha, let me just lay the facts on the table here. I was the Assistant Secretary of Housing that ran the FHA fund, which insured all of these mortgages, you know, and Ginnie Mae is a sister affiliate at HUD. And I was a partner and a member of the board of directors of one of the top investment banks in the country. And I have an MBA from Wharton. And there are people who will tell you I'm a financial genius. Now, I think that's an exaggeration, but there's no doubt I've really tried to understand this, and I cannot understand what's going on. So, you know, so I'm just trying to understand here, and if I can't understand, how's Lisa going to understand? And we're just trying to understand. So can we just dive in? And so what came out was the woman broke down, and she said, I'm so sorry, but, you know, I've never been able to understand this. And what we discovered is... So I said, well, you know, we're three smart people. We ought to be able to figure this out. So we went through the documents and just slugged through it together, and we finally figured it out, you know, and then we understood it. And I finally realized years later, oh, this is how they do all the mortgage fraud. You know, they make it impossible to understand how the financing relationships work. But, you know, at, that was a level, I've seen that level of complexity again and again and again. You know, it's just unbelievable. That's how a lot of the financial fraud and predatory lending happens.
I'm sure.
Well, right. Financial incentives to me are also a big thing. I mean, it's getting harder and harder to generate an income without playing ball with the official reality.
Yeah. And that's where the whole notion of the entrepreneur has to be preserved. It's
right.
Absolutely essential that, because it isn't complex. I mean, at the beginning, certainly,
right.
The whole idea, okay, you're going to generate some idea here. You're going to imagine something that hasn't been done before or not in this particular way. And it's going to be something, hopefully, that you want to do. It's not going to be like pulling teeth every step of the way. This is, you know, you're going to be inspired here at the beginning, and that's the key. If you're not inspired in any way, then you're on the wrong track here.
Right.
But, you know, this, of course, you can't find any institution of learning anywhere that's official that's going to try to really bring this home to people.
Right.
They have to do it themselves. They have to see that, yeah, there is a crack of light here. If you're the one who creates it, then okay, so you're the one who's in charge. You're the one who's going to decide what it looks like. You're the architect. What is it going to be? What do you want? These kinds of considerations at the very beginning of things, to me, mark the path that goes one way as opposed to the other way, which
right.
is down the road of official reality.
The, you know, right now, so much of the financial flows in the United States and the G7 countries is run through the government budgets. And one of the reasons I keep quoting the German finance minister in China, I guess it was Shanghai, in February, saying the debt growth model is over. You know, there are no shortcuts that aren't real reforms. And what he's saying by that is, you know, we've been able to enforce an official reality by throwing government-financed money at it to basically make things that aren't economic look economic or be economic. And now that the debt growth model is over, that game is coming to an end. And that is such a deep, big change, John. I keep talking about it because I don't think anybody begins to understand what this is going to look like and how big it is. But, you know, on the optimistic note, if the debt growth model goes away and we have to deal with an equity world, then fundamental economics get relevant again. And some of this weirdness and bizarreness of the official reality maybe goes away because it's just not economic.
Oh, yeah, that's an incredible statement that he made to say this.
It's unbelievable. The Germans are also good at cutting to the chase.
Yeah. I mean,
yeah.
I wonder what the Chinese reaction to that was.
You know, but they had neon signs flashing opportunity. Okay, social prestige, believe it or not, I think social prestige is more important for control than financial model. You know, I just, Franklin Sanders has this wonderful expression, he says with a deep Southern accent, he says, they pine for the treats of the tapeworm. You know, that little step up the, you know, you know, invite me into a commission, appoint me to the, you know, blah, blah, blah. Let me be seen at this party. And it's frightening. One of the things I always warn people is, you know, stay away from people who pine from the treats of the tapeworm, because there's no possibility for an energizing alignment if you're interested in reality.
That's for sure. Yeah. Now, you referred a little bit earlier to a piece, long audio piece of mine about Merlin. And what I was trying to do there was to say, okay, the age of magic, what was that? How is that? On what basis was that constituted? And what I was drawing out as I told this story was that there were many, many, many individuals, the overwhelming majority of individuals, who knew that they were inventing reality and were doing it. They were doing it, and they knew they were doing it, and they had far-reaching power to do it. And they were all there at the same time in the same place. And although from present standards that might seem extremely confusing and chaotic and so forth, it really wasn't, because everybody understood what was going on. It was a magical creative enterprise of the highest order. And the reason that I found that so bracing, so shall we say, was to picture that and to talk about it, was because to me that's one of the great things that has been lost, that people don't remember, that they, even if they did maybe remember, they would have difficulty trying to set it up in their mind as to what that's all about. And what we're talking about here, to me, issue after issue, is instead really a mechanical view of existence in the legal framework, in the financial framework, social prestige. All of these things amount to some kind of a mechanical presentation that everybody is supposed to fit into. And when people get that idea, okay, oh, this is what I'm supposed to do, then they scurry around in a big labyrinth trying to figure out what's the best way that I can fit into this system, as opposed to going back to, quote, the age of magic.
Right. Well, that brings me to one of my least favorite topics, which is media.
Oh, yes. Right.
Forced by media to be in the media business, here I am. The media, and I associate the media with technologies of control, but I always say in America, fact is fiction and fiction is fact. But I've found that people won't believe something's reality until it comes out of the mouth of the corporate media. And, you know, I once had an attorney who worked with me throughout the, you know, my 15 years of stopping and warning people about the housing bubble. She said, why is no one, you know, why did no one warn anyone? I said, wait a minute, I know the former assistant secretary who risked her life to warn everyone. And she said, yes, but you're nobody. And what I realized was somebody was the corporate media. Mm-hmm. So, you know, if you're, you know, so I said to her, look, if you need the enemy to affirm your credibility, you got a big problem.
Yeah, that's if only people would see it that way, you know. That, yeah, I'm with you 100% on this. Where do people get the idea of, let's call it, the reliable source? What is the reliable source? Well, for most people, it still is major media, because major media is busy all the time figuring out ways to look like the reliable source. That's their job. How do we do this? You know, well, and it gets down to very specific things. Okay, so who's our national news anchor? And does he have anything to do with the fact that our ratings are declining? And if so, what are we going to do about it? Because he's the voice. He is right. The bell ringer and the guy who's going through town, the town crier. He is the dispenser of information. And if he can't act well and be the reliable source for millions and millions of people, then we have a big problem. We're going to have to find somebody else. They're always calculating on every level possible, and it becomes unconscious after a while.
Right.
Okay, what's the set going to look like in the studio?
It's a lot of money and talent thrown at that.
Huge amounts. Huge amounts. Because if a crack appears suddenly, the game is over. You know, I mean, they are walking on eggshells. It's only the hypnotic state of the mass public that allows this to continue. And if suddenly there is, and I write about this endlessly, it seems, because I keep coming back to it. If this were understood, whatever, you know, this factoid that is being suppressed, and people really understood the implications of it, the game would be over. Because
right.
One domino after another would fall, people would understand that the whole thing has been propped up totally on the basis of what reliable source do people want and how can we be that thing so that they look at us and they say, well, this is just exactly what I've been looking for, and now I'm home and I can just take it by dictation, and I don't have to worry about whether true, false, misleading, that's all gone. I just, you know, I've got my reliable source. That's
so fine. I want to use some of the tactics they use that get pretty forceful. You know, one that shocked me when I first started to talk about what was really going on, you know, and do radio shows and go public, one of the things I discovered was that no one understood that a lot of people in leadership positions have control files. And we don't need to go into it. I have posts at Salieri if you're interested to know more about control files. But, you know, nobody gets to a certain point without somebody having dirt in their file. And, you know, the other thing that can happen is, you know, they can just invent it. I spent 11 years proving that they had just invented it. And I was very lucky. I was able to do it. But not everybody has 11 years and $6 million to spend on proving that it's a lie.
Yeah. Yeah, but you can see that sometimes the people who become, for example, billionaires, they were in on it from the beginning. Other times, not.
Right.
But they reach a certain level where all of a sudden people say, wow, you know, I thought this guy was just an entrepreneur, but now it seems like he's Jesus Christ. You know, he's saving the planet. He's got a foundation. He's got six foundations. And isn't this incredible? And so on and so forth. Well, yeah, because it's been pointed out to that person that
right.
when you reach a certain level, this is what you have to do if
right.
you want to keep what you have. Otherwise,
right.
bad things are going to happen to you.
Right.
And so one of the great deceptions, of course, and we've talked about this before, is the presentation that all of these wonderful things that are happening in the world by wonderful people who are in positions of power is all for the good of humanity. And the language used, the images used, everything is all...
We are here to help.
We're here to help. It's all altruism. We are right. the little helpers of the Messiah. And this is all what we're doing, and so on and so forth. And this, I mean, has existed as a con since the dawn of time on
right.
the planet. And it gets more and more sophisticated and more technological. But the thing about it is that this is the presentation. This is the way it's done. And therefore, everyone... as an individual who rises to a certain level of influence and power, is informed, more or less, this is the club you're now going to join. You are now going to be part of saving the world. that agenda. So learn the language, understand what you need to do. There's going to be large number amounts of donations that you're going to give to various programs. And, you know, incidentally, if you care to look below the surface, you're going to see that all of them are actually very harmful, but they're not going to be presented right that way. But this is your job to do this. And if you don't, then things will be taken away from you because we don't allow you to proceed beyond this point unless you join up.
The thing, you know, one of the things I most focus on in terms of technology control, and I've done a lot of book reviews over the last 2 years to try and get people educated to this, but I think since the cell tower build-out that ended in the summer of 2001, the use of mind control technologies like entrainment technology and subliminal programming on smartphones, on the internet, on TV, has just really gone to a whole new level. And I think the thing that I struggle with the most is there's a tremendous number of people that don't understand that that stuff exists and they can't fathom that somebody's using it on them.
Yeah. People certainly don't want to believe it. And I think ultimately what underlies all of that refusal to accept that is if you do accept it, then you have to say to yourself, okay, I don't want that. I want something else. And that something else is going to come, has to come from within me, within my own imagination, within my creative power. And if that is too daunting, then the person is going to really say, I'd rather be entrained. I'd rather be part of the, you know, the collective, hypnotized whole society, because the alternative is I step outside and then I begin to create reality on my own. That becomes
well, I've literally had people say that to me, say, look, you have the ability to create and maintain independent thought. I can't.
Right. I come across that as well. I can't do that. Can you help me?
Right.
You know? No.
Well, that's a good sign. Actually, you can. Reading your stuff helps enormously. It certainly helped me.
Yeah. I mean, it's sort of like the presentation is kind of like, look, I can't do that. All right. So what can you do for me now that I've told you I can't do that? Well, I don't know. I mean, you're really convinced that you can't do that, but what do you want? A trick? Some, I don't know, what would it be? Well, you know, what would be left if you say, well, I can't maintain that independence and keep on going? And of course, the truth is that people can. That's the way they're built, is to do that. So everything that we're discussing here legislates against that by attempting to give people a self-image where they say, well, look at that self-image. That means I can't be independent. I can't sustain independence. I can't do all these things. That's the phony reality. That's the official reality, really, that's being imposed on people.
Right. The last thing I just wanted to mention is false flags. And because the ability to create an official reality using violence is getting more and more common. I mean, we're watching an explosion in mass shootings or other sort of these terrorist events, and they're very extreme, and because of the violence, the pressure to get people to say, oh, yes, well, you know, Al-Qaeda exists. It's an organization, and it has a board and governance structures and bylaws. And
Right.
It, you know, it becomes, and of course it's a major job to prove that a false flag is a false flag, and who's got the time when, you know, it's one a week. So false flags are clearly a new, I would say it shows you how fragile the official reality is that they're having to go to this extreme.
I think so. I think there's a lot of people who've read 1984 that still don't get it. Because that's, to me, maybe the best book about false flags that was ever written.
Right. Right.
The unending war that goes on,
right,
that's presented every day on television, and how anything can be changed at the drop of a hat. This enemy,
right,
suddenly becomes an ally, and that ally suddenly becomes an enemy, and now we have to hate that area, and, you know, and everything changed. But it doesn't matter. Okay. It just, the broadcast goes on and on and on, and people come to accept it, when in fact the whole thing is a complete hoax. And nobody really knows. You feel on certain pages of the book that, gee, you know, nobody even really knows whether this war is actually going on or not to begin with. Because it's just on television, and people are all bottled up in their little apartments and towing the line, so how could they know? And, gee, what if it's not even going on? You know, these thoughts begin to creep in at the edges very seriously. I mean, to me, if anybody still has some questions about the psychology of false flags, just reread 1984. That's going to take
right.
you right to the center of it.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Now that you have smart TVs and you have smartphones and the internet is clearly smart, and what you've got is you've got this extraordinary feedback loop between, you know, you basically have everybody connected to the network, and the machinery, the data beast, is sucking up the intelligence in real time. You know, it can use it for insider trading. It can use it for all sorts of consumer products. But it's almost as though, like, you have a co-creation of the official reality now that you have this deeply invasive, you know, technology. There's a wonderful new book being written on what's called surveillance capitalism. You know, because Facebook and Google and all these guys were basically invented to do this on a for-profit basis. You know, why do this with government contracts when you can make money doing it? And, you know, so it really is a bit of a co-creation. If the official reality is not working, you're going to have to constantly tweak it, and you've got the feedback to do it. You know, it's funny. I have all sorts of wonderful allies who say, well, the most the NSA could ever listen to is 20,000 people. It's too labor intensive. They can't contemplate. This is all done by artificial intelligence. You don't need humans.
Right.
It's a machine project.
Sure. Look at all the trolls on comment sections on the internet. More and more of those trolls are, you know,
machines.
Machines.
Yeah.
So you suddenly get to, how dare he say this, and I'm going to reply to it. No, there isn't any he, you know. It's just somebody figured out a few algorithms, pretty simple, generated some responses, calculated to drive other people nuts and get them screaming and arguing at each other, and that's what happens. And, boy, I'd really like to meet that person. No, you wouldn't. There isn't any person. It's a machine. You know, so I mean, talk as another false flag, you know, is well, I'm going to get that guy one of these days, and we're going to run into each other somewhere. We'll recognize each other somehow, and I'm going to really take care of this guy. No, you're not. He doesn't exist. Never has, you know. It's just, you know, it's like watching.
It's your entertainment soft butt. Okay, well, let's go to, let's now turn to the key, the core issue here. How do people in the know communicate with people who are deeply committed to the official reality? How do we manage that situation? And first, I want to talk about people in the know, because I did a great interview with you, I don't know, it was about 5 years ago, I don't know if you remember, where we talked about people in the know. I divide people in the know between people who are interested in being positive and productive and people who are not interested in being positive and productive. I'm more afraid of a lot of the people in the know than I am of the, you know, people committed to the official reality. Well, because here's the thing. You get a lot of people who know that the official reality is a bunch of bunk, but they go off in search of alternative realities and get trapped in, you know, fantasies, and I call them adult fairy tales, that are worse than the official and more dangerous than the official reality.
Yeah. There's there's some sort of an addiction factor, shall we say? You know,
because yeah.
It's like, where do I find adrenaline? Okay, well, if I go to this crazy story where it turns out that, you know, Canada doesn't exist at all. I saw a video on YouTube, and it said at the northern border of the United States, if you take a step across, you'll be at the North Pole. Wow. Okay, now we're talking. Now I can start to feel the adrenaline pumping. If this were, and there's a reason for this, because in a metaphorical sense, that kind of wild and crazy story is pointing out that official reality is a fantasy, is a cardboard facade. Yes, but it's doing it in such a crazy way that if you happen to buy that story about Canada, you're off and running in such bizarre territory. Who knows what you're going to do based on that if you suddenly base your whole existence on this, you know, insane story. Yeah, you could become dangerous. You definitely could become dangerous, yeah.
Well, it's very clever, because what I've found is the guys who invent the official reality say, look, if you don't like the official reality, then we want to trap you in an alternative reality that still makes us money.
You bet.
And a lot of the, I just wanted to run through some of them.
Sure.
Because a lot of them scare me. You know, I'm an investment advisor, so I bump into these all the time and they scare me to death. So let me give you a couple of them. One is the Iraqi dinar scheme.
Da-da,
you know, or it's what I call, yeah, my big ship is coming in. You know, next year I'm going to be worth $100 million and everything's going to be solved, because I can solve it with money.
Yeah. And if it's not next year, that just means, you know, they haven't quite put it together, but it'll happen the next year. And the goalposts keep getting moved back.
Right. Then another one is the, you know, the great savior. So the aliens are going to come and save us, or the white dragon elder family in China is going to come, or the Asians, you know, the Asian elders are going to come save us. And that one always infuriates me, because if you look at China, you know, they've got a per capita income of $10,000 to $13,000 a year, and they've got real environmental problems. You know, if there are Asian families with great wealth, they ought to be helping, you know, pull everybody in Asia up. They don't need to be spending their money, you know, coming over here and helping people who are making $55,000 a year avoid facing their problems some more.
Really? Yeah, absolutely. All right.
Okay. Mm-hmm. So
I agree. To divert people into a secondary reality. So, okay, right. You don't want official reality. How about this one? This is a good one here. So to try to define the space of alternatives, my old friend Peter Chalka, great journalist, wrote extensively about what happened at the National Institutes of Health during the 1990s when they decided, okay, we need to throw a bone to alternative medicine. So let's form a little department over here that we'll promote with a lot of publicity, and we'll drag in all kinds of alternative practitioners, and we'll give out a little bit of grant money to do meaningless studies that really, you know, don't add up to anything. And all of a sudden, we'll shift the whole framework here so that we're now talking about, quote, integrated medicine, and we'll just make these true healers vanish, because we'll have a new bureaucracy that we just created in this alternative reality. And they did call it the Office of Alternative Medicine for a while. That was their alternative that they built in order to trap people who, you know, rejected official medicine.
Right. Another one is go to this, here's this wonderful country with great health care and low costs, and if you just leave the United States and go there and stop being a voter and stop irritating us, everything will be wonderful and your life will be perfect again. Now, you know, there are many people who, there are many expats who are very happy, but there are also a tremendous number of people who've been cycled into something, you know, that makes absolutely no sense for them. And because it's really been sold as a, you know, the away fantasy. Go away and somehow you can get away from all of this, even though what we're dealing with is a completely global phenomena.
Right. Yeah. I used to be trapped in that one maybe 40 years ago, looking for the person. Okay. Got to be somewhere here. I'm going to find it and go there and disappear, and everything's going to be great. You know. Yeah, absolutely.
I had a wonderful friend who said, my first year in Paris was the most wonderful year of my life. And she'd been in Paris for 2 years. I said, what happened in the second year? She said, well, at the end of the first year, I learned to speak French. And what I discovered was that for the first year, I was protected from the psychic storm. But as soon as I could hear the psychic storm, I realized it was no different than where I come from.
That's a great story. The ultimate lesson of that is don't learn the language, you know. Then you can stay there for maybe 10 years, right?
Okay, so let's talk about the people. So people in the know, you know, is a complex group. It's not just one kind of people. People who are absolutely committed to the official reality break down into a lot of different kinds of people. So let's see if we can't explore that a little. What do the people committed to the official reality look like?
Passive. They welcome the official reality, and they are, I have to say, more and more are being led to believe that anyone who doesn't is actually now a threat, is not just some sort of kook, more curious person on the outside, but they're a threat or at the very least mentally ill and they need treatment. So this is now becoming more and more present among people who buy the official reality. I think they feel more threatened. They're being led to feel more threatened, like, okay, this is the last outpost of sanity, and we have to protect what we have, and all of that kind of stuff. I see more and more of those characteristics.
Well, I also see, it depends on the generations, but in the older folks, I see their ignorance as being a risk strategy. In other words, they know something's terribly wrong, but they kind of feel like playing ball with the official narrative is in their best interest. It's really funny, after 9/11, people stop looking you straight in the eye.
Yeah.
It's because they know. You know, they know. Or you had a whole generation of people who stopped saying, you know, it's a free country. Before 1996, you used to always hear that, well, it's a free country. No one ever says that anymore. So I think there's, you know, above a certain age, everybody knows. They just, you know, they don't want to fight City Hall. Mm-hmm. You know, and then the younger you get, I don't know, it divides, because you get the truly naive, but you get some young people who are so skeptical of the whole system. They've been burnt so badly that they're, you know, they can be much more knowledgeable. I will say this, what I see is more and more people either just purely, completely mind-controlled by the technology or really, really scared.
Yeah. You certainly see more people controlled by the technology. I mean,
right.
Who would have thought 15 years ago that you could walk down the street and see more than half the people on the street looking at their cell phones as they're walking down the street? If you presented that as a picture 15, 20 years ago, this is what it's going to look like. You'd say, well, I don't even know what you're talking about. What do you mean? Totally entrapped and trained by this, you know, official reality coming through the screen.
It's really funny. Whenever a plane lands, there are always some people who don't just grab their phone and turn it on. And all the people who do grab their phone and turn it on, the people who don't grab their phone and turn it on are kind of, we're looking at each other, watching them, and realizing, you know, there's a great divide here. And you know, and we kind of look at each other as though we're approaching a big uh-oh.
Right.
Okay, well, I want to talk about the risk areas, because when I try and communicate with people who are committed to the official reality for all the different reasons, You know, it's one thing if we're in a cocktail party and we're just talking, you know, we're meeting each other and talking about the weather. It's another thing if it's a doctor who's got, you know, a form that has control over my life. So I find that communications are very different for different kinds of risk areas. And to me, the number one most important risk area is health. And I don't know anybody who's explored the depth of, you know, these challenges more than you, and particularly some of your incredible interviews with healthcare practitioners dealing with the real risk issues. You know, when the official reality, when the official narrative is designed to kill you physically, you know, this is a big problem, and communication can get very tense.
Very tough. Yeah, sure. Especially, you know, it's one thing if you're facing the executioner and he knows what he's about to do and so do you, and it's pretty clear. But when you have somebody who's highly educated, who's adamantly saying that you have to follow his advice because this is the only thing that can save you, but yet it's going to kill you, wow, now you're in deep water, really deep water. I mean, to avoid, whenever possible, that situation would certainly be the number one recommendation. I mean, if you're dealing with official reality in a high-risk situation, you have to ask yourself, why am I here to begin with? I mean, is there really something here that I need that will be provided to me? Or did I really, you know, get off the elevator on the wrong floor and I don't even, you know it? I just, this is really crazy and I have to turn around immediately and go out.
Well, anything, so health is an area, finances is a big area. And, you know, for a long time as an investment advisor, I would find men and women coming to talk to me because they were having real serious fights about what to do with their investment. And it was interesting. One of the things I discovered was that you can, the official reality can trick a man or they can trick a woman, but it's almost impossible to trick a man and a woman working together. Believe it or not, there's kind of a magic to it. But it's really dangerous for, in a marriage or in a family, when you've got somebody in the know who knows how to protect the family, and you're dealing with people when it comes to family health or family investments who are completely bought into the official narrative in a way that's dangerous or which is easily manipulated. And there's no one, the most painful recently, of course, is when it has to do with your children and grandchildren. And that's why the vaccine issue keeps bringing this issue up of how do we communicate with people in the official reality, because you've got two parents, one of which wants to put their kids through heavy schedules of vaccines, and another parent who knows the chances of the kid, particularly if it's a boy, becoming autistic are remarkably high. And they also know, as one vax mother said, that's going to cost us $5 million present value. You know, we're basically going to take our entire financial strength over our lifetime and have to dedicate it to this child if they become severely autistic. So you're talking about one health mistake destroying the family finances for the next 50 years, you know, including destroying not only that child's life, but potentially the other siblings as well.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of a situation that's more defines what we're talking about than this one. The bridge, the gulf between official reality and somebody who knows what the actual reality is.
Right.
You know, to me, the answers are not mechanical. It's you're in a struggle, so what do you do? The first thing you do is you don't compromise if you know the truth. You stand on that. But then you can say to yourself, well, you know, I can make this a lot worse than it already is if I say this, that, and the other thing, as opposed to this and that. But I find that most people who say, I don't know how to talk to somebody in this case, or really in any case, who is a representative, a card-carrying member of official reality. I just don't know how to talk to them. The problem to me really begins when you don't know exactly what you're standing up for, or you haven't made up your mind what you're standing up for to the point of commitment. Because if that is clear, then you're going to find ways to do the best that you can. It's not going to be such an insurmountable problem. So to me, many times there's kind of a mask effect here. The person is saying one thing, I don't know how to talk to people who represent official reality, but really the problem is I haven't yet committed to knowing what I know. I haven't committed to standing for it and understanding what that means, and then beginning to flesh out the ramifications of that, because I'm not going to budge from that no matter what. That is not going to happen. I find that people who do know and do stand up and do make a commitment find ways. They do find ways to communicate with people who represent official reality. It may not always be pleasant, it may not always be productive, but they do find ways. So I would look to that. I know for myself it's true, because over time I developed that commitment and realized I was developing it. Okay, so this is what I'm saying, this is what I'm writing, well, this is what I stand for, right? I mean, am I going to just abandon this, or, you know, because it gets to be a little unpleasant, or what?
Right, that happens to me. I try to pick my fights just because, you know, the hacking bill can run $5,000 to $10,000 when I get my dander up. So it just is an economic matter. I can't afford to pick that fight every day. But, you know, again and again, I come back to the fact of, wait a minute, I'm on the side of reality. Somebody's got to do it. So I'm not backing down on that.
Right.
Because, you know, what's the point? One of the things I wanted to mention was that if you look at the children's and grandchildren issue, there are two ones. One is vaccines, and the other is Common Core. And I just Joseph Farrell just co-authored a book that just published this month on Common Core. And I wrote the foreword, and one of the things I say, I recommend that foreword to you, but one of the things I say is, look, you cannot put your children in public school anymore. It's over. There's no compromise, because if you look at the invasion of their privacy and the sort of messing with their minds, you know, I mean, if you're going to do that to a child, you shouldn't have a child. And that is, for a busy working mother, that is an enormously inconvenient message. Oh, I've got to take my children out of public schools. I've got to move out of California because I can't allow them to be vaccinated. You know, this is a big change. And it's, some people don't have the economic resources that make it look feasible. So it's a deeply inconvenient message.
Yes, it is. And yet, there it is.
You know? Right.
So, if something isn't easy and you try to make it easy as your primary strategy, it's not really going to work.
Right.
Well, this doesn't look easy. That's not right. It should be easy. So, where is the easy? And you keep looking for it, and it's not there. Okay, so I guess then that I'm just going to have to fold up my tent and stay where I am and do what everybody else does. No, absolutely not.
Right.
And now, and we discussed this before in different ways, decentralization of power. What happens if next year the number of homeschooling parents triples in the United States, and then the next year quadruples? eventually it's going to reach a point where it's going to be very, very difficult for the powers that be to do anything about it. And if you want to look on the level of the big picture for an answer, to me, that's where it is. There is a tipping point and a threshold which you cross in any area that you might want to look at that's crucial, like education, where when enough decentralization occurs, then the game is over. There's no way to control it anymore because it's just spreading like crazy. This, in fact, is the problem that the medical cartel has been dealing with for a long time, because what's loosely called the natural health movement has exploded to such a degree, not just in the United States, but in other countries, that, okay, you know, wow, this is, what are you going to do? You're going to tell people, what are you going to tell them? How are you going to convince them that their concept of health is dangerous? Can we really do that successfully and win? Well, they're trying. That's part of the vaccine agenda. But on the whole, I would say they're not succeeding.
The best thing that ever happened to my health was the litigation, because then I couldn't access traditional health care, and it broke the trance. And I discovered how much I could do for myself, and that, in fact, I was much safer doing it for myself. So it's...
And that's a revelation, right? Wow.
Yeah, the healthcare system is very dangerous and getting more dangerous daily. Okay, so here's my biggest struggle as an investment advisor. I spend an enormous amount of time telling people how essential it is for your personal safety and protecting your time and money that you only do business or associate with institutions or people who have high integrity. Why is that such a hard sell?
Yeah.
Why do we think it's safe to bank at J.P. Morgan Chase? I don't get it. You know, again and again, they settle, because they have a profit-sharing arrangement with the government where they kick back money. And they settle, you know, billions of dollars for fraud after fraud after fraud. Why do you think that you can do business with them and it's safe? I don't get it.
I don't get it either. Again, it's not easy. Okay, so I'm going to have to rearrange my life. How do I do that? How do I find the people who have integrity and then deal with them and eliminate the other people?
Well, what I found, if you try your best to have integrity, they find you.
Yeah. That's for sure. That certainly works. There is that magic, and it does work if you keep it up long enough. I mean, I think a lot of people have seen that. If you take the area in your life where you really have made a commitment and stood up for something that's good, and you maintain that, and it's not just a thought in your mind, but it's backed up by action, as time goes by, people show up. People show up who are good, and they help you, and they see what you are, and they want to be associated with you.
It's quite amazing. You know, as I travel around, I try and have lunches where people can meet. And I'm always stunned at the quality of the people who are our subscribers. I mean, these are the most amazing, cool, competent, ethical people all over the world. They're everywhere. And, you know, I feel like saying, where have all you guys been hiding? They're there. They're absolutely there. Well, let's say, let's go into the deep dive. We've got a, you know, every day we deal with people who are vested in the official reality. We deal with them at work. We deal with them, you know, when they show up to do pest control. We deal with them in every aspect of our lives. How do you manage that communication? You know, what do you do that works for you?
I would say the best thing that I do is if I'm dealing with them on some sort of a business or professional level, I get as specific as I can.
Right.
I don't want anything vague, anything general. I want everything spelled out. I want everything to be very specific. That's my best chance, at least, of having an outcome that's not going to be harmful, to be able to see, okay, here's a situation. This is what I want. This is a good thing to want. And I'm going to have to make this extraordinarily clear and specific to this other person in this, relationship, whatever it is, of the moment. That, to me, helps me a great deal.
Right.
If I do that, I got a fighting chance. If I don't, I'm sunk.
Right, and I find it's very important to work at an intimate level or a local level. And you're right, to keep things very specific on the common project or the common, whatever it is we're going to do together, and just stay focused. I hate to say it, on mechanical things, save time, make money, lower risk. And I'm always cognizant of the fact, among people who are vested in the official reality, John, there are people who enjoy doing evil. I mean, as one of our common allies always says, you've got to understand that evil exists. And, I live in a world where there's always somebody who could make money tipping, the enforcement arm or dirty tricking you. So that's the other thing I'm always watching out for, the economic warfare possibilities when I deal with somebody who's really committed to the official reality.
Yeah. I mean, sure. If it gets to be on major projects, I would say you can expect that to be happening. And I've seen a few where it was very opaque to begin with. What's going on here? Who is this person? Okay, I'm going to take this one step at a time because I want to see what's happening here. And eventually, here we go. Here we go. This is the punchline that I've been waiting for. And here now it comes because that's the way that game is being played. But again, for me, and I think for other people, if I know where I'm going and it's the direction I want to go in and I'm committed to it, I have perspective now. So I can look at people, deal with people who represent official reality based on that, as opposed to some kind of, candy stripe fantasy about how everything is going to be fine.
Right. One of the reasons we do Let's Go to the Movies on the Salieri Report is to constantly recommend movies or documentaries that can help you communicate about what's really going on in a way that's effective. Because I find it's a lot easier to get somebody to watch. I just keep waiting for Vax to be available. But there's a wonderful new documentary on vaccines or related to vaccines, mercury poisoning, called Trace Amounts. If you can batch up a bunch of good documentaries, it helps tremendously. So
yeah, I think that's a very good thing that you're doing with that. Because, somebody sits there and watches a documentary. Okay, so they may not come out of it saying, you're right, this is incredible, I see it now, whatever. But they're going to realize, at the very least, that they can't just keep faking it with you. Because they've now seen this documentary. They know something is going on here. It's disturbing to them. They've been sort of put through the mill by watching it. And things are not going to be the same after that. Not going to be exactly the same. Because they're not trying to convince you. They're just sitting there watching something. There's nobody
right.
to convince.
Right. One of the things I wanted to ask you about is I have And this gets into the whole concept of morphogenic fields, which I think is a very important area to learn about if you're going to deal with this communication across divergent realities. And I always recommend Lynn McTaggart's book, The Field, just as an intro, or Rupert Sheldrake's book, The Presence of the Past. So I'll mention those. And we've had Lynn McTaggart on the Salieri Report, a great interview that gets into all of this, so I won't repeat it here. But what I've discovered is if you, let's say you have two people, one is me and the other is a, you know, a wonderful vendor who does some kind of business that has nothing to do with any of these things, you know, landscaping or pest control. There's all sorts of functions that we can do together that have nothing to bear on, you know, reality versus official reality. But what I've noticed is if they're deeply committed to the official reality, communication on a project that is completely unrelated to that divergence doesn't go as well. In other words, if I have somebody doing landscape who, you know, is in the know, I'm going to get a much better result than I have somebody doing landscape who's not in the know. In many cases, you know, it's a probability thing. And it's almost as though if your electromagnetic or morphogenic fields are not aligned on these deep issues, communication is harder. It's baffling. I mean, it's not, if you understand morphogenic fields, it's not baffling. But, you know, one of the reasons I think I hear from subscribers and clients so much pain on this point is, you know, you have a whole world of people who are kind of disappearing into, you know, zombie zone, and it's getting harder and harder to communicate with them on anything.
Right. And so you have to find people who are not zombies and communicate with them. And I agree with you about projects and jobs and so forth. When you deal with somebody who knows the score,
uh-huh,
and the project really doesn't have anything to do with anything, it's just, as you say, you know, we're gonna do some landscaping. It goes easier because you look at each other and you know, okay, the understanding in the field, so to speak, is deeper. So
right.
What's happening on the surface here with this job is going to be easier to bring off. And people are naturally going to talk to each other in a way to make themselves understood, as opposed to obfuscation and legal documents that are 50 pages long that you could spend a month reading and still never understand. The people are going to get down to brass tacks because they know that's what the other person wants, and they want it too. It's a joy, in a way, to find somebody like that, because you can say, okay, ABC, and they go, you bet, ABC, I know what you're talking about.
Yeah.
That's what's going to happen here, and it does. And you look at each other, and you say, well, look what we did. Okay, great.
Your imaginations can link up. You're free to link up.
Mm-hmm.
I just went through a strategic planning process with two of the smartest guys in our network on retail, very deep, extraordinary retail experience. And my question was, you know, is it possible to take the people in the know who have a very positive, productive attitude and create a new field? And can the Salieri Report and our allies contribute to doing that? And can that group of people, you know, will this system tolerate that leakage? And it was very inspiring because I came back believing, yes, absolutely, they can. And what I've come to realize is, you know, and this happened, I don't know, a couple years ago, but now it's accelerating having done this. I just don't have time for people who are not in the know, who don't have a positive attitude. You know what I mean? In other words, there's a certain group of us who really believe that we can use our imaginations to create a free and inspired life, not just for ourselves, but for everybody. And we're just going to do it. And I don't think you need a lot of people. I think a tiny group can, you know, create a field that makes an enormous shift in what's going on. And I just don't have time for anybody else except people who want to do that.
to me, that's a very healthy attitude. Just on the basis of time and effort alone, if you wanted to look at it that way.
Right.
And sort of chart it out. How much time would you have to spend with somebody who's embedded in official reality to try to get anything across? And if you manage somehow to be successful, what would that really mean? I mean, how much difference would it make except for a moment? So I don't see the advantage of that either. I never really have. It just never added up to me. It's like...
Well, because I think deep inside, a lot of us still pine for the treats of the tapeworm. You know, we're looking to be included. We're looking to be honored. We're looking to be, you know, it gets back to that prestige ladder.
Yeah,
This is not a problem you have.
What excites me, and I think underneath it all excites many people, is the idea. Well, on the other hand, if I could create something on my own, or with a small group of like-minded souls, and it was terrific and wonderful and sensational and successful, then do I really need somebody to come in and say, we're going to give you a plaque at a rubber chicken luncheon next week, and we'd like you to be there? I mean, is that really... Does anybody care about that? If you've been able to do this other thing and it works, you know, and I see it as the answer is a resounding no. It doesn't matter, and you don't care, and you, in fact, avoid it, you know, at all costs, because it doesn't make any difference, and it's just a waste of time. So the prestige thing goes out the window because you've managed to create your own prestige, which is an inner factor.
Right. Right. And I think, you know, it's funny, to me the most powerful message from this conversation, John, is what you're saying about you have to be absolutely clear about where you stand, what you want, and you have to be prepared to communicate it effectively and not apologize for it. You have to be willing to provide your own prestige.
Yeah, and people recognize that. Even people who are robots respond to that in some way.
Right.
I used to talk about families on this basis, conflict in families. Now, if the one person in the family who is doing what he or she really wants to do just keeps on doing it, regardless of the slings and the arrows from everybody else and all of their, you know, freely offered opinions at every moment, eventually everybody is going to retreat. They're going to say, well, that's what she's doing. Okay, I mean, you know, can't stop her. It's just what's happening. All right. That's what happens. I've seen it. I've done it. I've been involved in it. I've watched it, other people in that situation. But those people don't back down. And that's the key. And then there's the issue of time. It's not that they just don't back down at that moment or this moment. They never back down. And it doesn't have to be brutal, you know, and offensive. It's just, this is what I'm doing.
Right.
And then eventually everybody says, oh, okay, all right.
Oh, well, John, it's such a joy to talk to you about this. One of my favorite John Rappaport's speeches was the one you gave at Secret Space Program 2014, where you basically got up and told people to go invent their own, you know, to invent their lives. And it was quite remarkable. I was sitting next to a group of people who were just, oh my God. And I'll never forget getting home and seeing a great ally of mine who'd been listening to the speech, and he was sitting smiling by himself at the kitchen table. I said, what are you doing? He said, I'm thinking about inventing my next big thing.
Yeah, great.
Yeah. As a result of your speech. But then that night we were on the panel and some guy got up and said, you know, well, you know, you guys need to do something on this. And you were remarkable. You blasted him and you said, you know something? Everybody up on this panel has been doing a ton of stuff for years. What are you going to do?
I do remember that.
And of course, what you were assuming was, hey, pal, you have the ability to invent our world, too.
Yeah. It's so all a very positive thing. You know, even the critique is positive. It's just, it's not, no, go away, never again. It's, wait a minute, come on, you know, I know who you are.
Right.
The mask is not going to do you any good, or trying to shift the responsibility onto us, you know, for yet one more thing. You can do it, so go do it. Let's go.
Right. Well, I've told you this story before, but I want to close my part of this with it. When I started Hamilton Securities Group, we used to be doing all these, we used to call it sort of Da Vinci's Workshop, because Da Vinci's Workshop was a place where you would invent something and then you had to invent the tools to make it. So, you know, there was a lot of invention going on. And so we would commit to doing a transaction, and then I'd break it down into different pieces, and I'd say, okay, for the optimization technology, we're going to have to invent something. And people would say, well, we can't do this deal. And I said, what do you mean we can't do this deal? And they said, well, we don't know how to do this deal. And I said, well, we're just going to hire an optimization expert to figure out the optimization software. You know, so we'll just invent that part. And they said, well, you can't do that. We have to be an expert to do that. And I said, well, wait a minute. Nobody's ever done this before, so there are no experts.
No.
But we're going to hire somebody who's an expert in a parallel field and then bring it over and invent this. And they were like, you can't do that. And what I realized is I'd been trained to believe that I could invent my world. And they'd been trained to believe that they couldn't. You know, and that was a class divide that was extraordinary.
It's a real shock.
And we've got to break it down. And the reason I keep promoting your work so aggressively to our subscribers is you have a body of work that really helps people who've been programmed to believe that they can't invent their world to start to grapple and come out of that trance and start to invent their world. And I'll give you an example. You know, one of my favorite comments from a subscriber who listened to our interview, The Matrix Revealed, one of my favorite Salary Report interviews, she wrote in and she said, oh my God, you know, I've been going to all these New Age seminars my whole life where they tell me I can invent their, you know, my reality, and it never works. And then I listened to John Rappaport explain how the establishment invents my reality for me. And now I realize I can invent my reality, because if they can invent my reality for me, I can do it for myself. So maybe just in closing, talk about some of the materials that we can access at No More Fake News and your website to help us do that. How do we, you know, we each have to come out of this trance. Help us, tell us how we can access your work to come out of this trance.
Okay. Well, the website is nomorefakenews.com. It's been there for 15 years now. And I have three collections, The Matrix Revealed, Exit from the Matrix, and Power Outside the Matrix. And these are mega collections that are put together. They're not just ideas. There are many exercises that one can do, very specific. And the whole idea is to increase one's ability to invent their own reality, their own world. That's the whole point of that. And so you can see and read about those collections on the website and order them and jump in. That's really why I'm doing everything that I'm doing.
All the imagination exercises really stretch your capacity to think about possibilities and create possibilities. You have a book in those collections called The Secret of Secret Societies. And, you know, you have your interviews, which I love. which really explore with insiders about how the nuts and bolts of consensus reality is created. And, you know, those are three of my favorite pieces that really help you do it. But you have a, you know, you have a great deal of stuff. If somebody was just going to start with one piece, what would you have them start with?
Well, for your subscribers, I would say Exit from the Matrix. Start
Exit
with
from the Matrix. Okay.
That'll keep you busy for quite a while. And you'll new ideas and all sorts of popping things will be happening the longer you work with the material and the more you do the exercises. Because that is the idea. There are things that we don't know about, we'll never know about until we begin to use our imaginations sufficiently.
Right.
And then things go, oh, look at this. I hadn't thought of it before, or I hadn't looked at it from that angle before, and this could help me, and I could do so. Oh, yeah, I could do, sure. This is all on the road to inventing the world that you want for yourself, for others, for everybody.
There's many of us who, when the you know, sort of the official reality gets to, you know, it gets very, I don't know, it just seems like an overwhelming amount of saltwater taffy glue, intellectual glue. We go and read your almost daily blog post that just cuts right through the chase, and you know, you're like the foo dog who keeps the goo out. Just, you know, so I laugh throughout the day. And as I said, when we started this, I really appreciate your recent burst recent burst of daily slaughters against the official reality. Go.
And let me say one final thing, and that is, without going into a long song and dance, there was a point maybe 4 years ago, 5 years ago, when I wasn't really sure whether I was going to continue with this.
Uh-huh.
Because it looked like there were certain limitations that I wasn't seeing past. And I talked to you. We had a brief conversation. You said, ding, 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 dong, dong. And I said, oh, okay. Now,
really?
Everything since then has been on an upward trend. Everything has been on an upward trend, right? It was
just a brief conversation.
I said, I'm not sure what to do with this or that, the other thing. And you said, well, do this, you know. And I thought, yeah, how come I haven't thought of that myself? Okay, that's it. I'm going to invent that, and then we'll see what happens. And I did, and then almost overnight, it was, well, look at what's happening now.
Wow.
Many thanks for that.
Oh, listen, you know, it's just your good work coming back around. I've been doing your imagination exercises. Okay, well, John Rappaport, Human Communications Across the Reality, Official Reality Divide. It's an exploration. We have a lot more to think about and figure out. Because if I can help our subscribers really become masterful at navigating this divide, boy, that would be so energizing for all of us. So you have a wonderful day. Thanks again for your help.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Bye.